Hello, and welcome to Be Indie Now, a podcast about independent game development. I'm your host, Tobias Marks, and with me today is The Panic Room, a team of students from UC Santa Cruz, starting with Ethan.
Yeah, how's it going?
And Alex.
Hey, how are you?
And Taylor.
Hey, Tobias.
So you guys formed your team for a class that you're taking.
Yes, we did.
What's the class?
It's a computer science class, upper div elective. And it's just a game making studio class. Mm-hmm. So just dedicated to creating a game.
So this is not your first game creation class you did?
No, it's not.
Like, so how many games do you think you guys made before?
I'd say we all made about 3 games each.
Yeah, have you guys worked together before? Or is this the first time you guys had your team?
This is the first time that the three of us have personally worked together. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I've personally only made 3 games, mm-hmm. From CS80K, which was the first one, and then, another game design class, CS20, and then this one, 179.
Cool.
Yep.
So how did you guys like meet? Did you just meet because you all took the same class, or you know each other ahead of time?
One of the parts I liked about the class that we all took was in the beginning, they had a sort of freeform period, where we'd all preach our ideas and we all gravitate towards the idea that sounded the most sensible. It's similar to, I read last year the Valve Handbook, a mm-hmm. really cool resource, but I noticed there were some similarities between the handbook and the way the class was structured. And that's basically how the group formed. It was not so much a cut and paste type of deal. It was more of like an organic molecule, and one of us was the nucleus and the amoeba that formed around it. Basically turned into the team. That
makes sense. So what are you guys' different roles? Like, who's artist, who's programmer?
Well, I'm the back-end programmer. Mm-hmm. I programmed all the game stuff.
I did all of the front-end stuff, so, you know, like menus, making it look pretty, all that kind of fun stuff.
And I was in charge of design, and also with that, I carried on the art role as well.
Very cool. So let's take a step back a bit. Why do you guys want to make games in the first place? Why are you guys in college to make games?
Well, apart from the side that software is just really cool, intriguing, and it presents a challenge every single day. Also, from the fact that it doesn't kill people. It's not like a drone. Yeah.
You like the idea drone. Of, like, you know, you're providing entertainment. It's a pretty good world goal.
Yeah, it's entertainment. It brings smiles to people's faces, and it does so. It's a really cool medium. Mm-hmm. Our games as an expression, it has a lot more versatility than audio or, I would say, movies. In that sense, it also presents a really cool technical challenge. So you get the best of both worlds. You get the artistic side, and you also get the technical side. From that perspective, I think games were totally right for me, and that's also a reason why I came to UC Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm. I don't think my reason's as good. I definitely just love playing video games growing up, and playing like games like World of Warcraft that have millions upon millions of players, I just thought like that would be so much fun to be able to be a part of creating a game that caused just millions of people to flock towards it and play it and have time of their life. And I thought it would just be, you know, the best thing ever to be able to do that. So that's why I came to UC Santa Cruz to get my game design degree.
Yeah, my reason is very similar to Alex's. I've been really passionate about games ever since I was little, ever since I first started playing those point-and-click adventure games for 4-year-olds. I knew I wanted to make video games from about the age of 9 years old, and I didn't have much experience coming in, but UC Santa Cruz is definitely the right choice for that.
Yeah, I think like 9 was probably the age that I really started taking games more seriously and wanting to analyze them. What about you two? Was it young for you, or was this a decision you came later in life?
Oh, dude, it was really young. My parents... I like to think most of my elementary school education was covered by it was this PBS program called The Magic School Bus.
I love that show.
And what they did was they released a series of educational video games. They had them for all sorts of subjects.
Mm-hmm, like, that was the human body one. That was my favorite.
Did you ever play the paleontology one with dinosaurs and stuff like that?
Yeah, I remember that one.
That was by and far one of my favorite games growing up. And then also, it was this one really crazy game called Putt-Putt Goes to the Moon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love the whole Putt-Putt series.
There was a whole meaning messages behind that, I swear. There's like, I think I bumped into one guy on the internet, and he was dissecting Putt-Putt. And I thought it was pretty interesting. It's a little far out there, but overall, it really got me inspired.
Yeah, I mean, like those kind of games are really well designed to be very, very accessible. So you can learn a lot about them because they were designed for kids. They're designed to get kids not really into gaming per se, but they were educational to teach something. And when you're in the mobile industry now, it's all about accessibility. And it's all about players who are not used to playing games and not knowing any of the conventions. So a lot of the stuff that was pioneered in educational games in the 90s is what's the forefront of design right now. So speaking of design right now, tell me about the game idea that your team's been working on.
Yeah, the game decided to make was the one we were preaching early on in the course was so much because the course was sponsored by Microsoft, and we were allowed to use these really sweet Surface tablets. Mm-hmm. The Surface device, as we inspected, has a huge screen. So the game we wanted to make utilized that huge screen in a way, and it would be based all completely on touching and swiping and stuff like that. Things that you could do with your hands, because although the Microsoft Surface tablet does have an optional keyboard, mm-hmm. natively speaking, I think it would mean more. And I thought we could.
You want to go for a primary touch interface.
Oh, yeah, totally. I think it's a lot more.
A lot more touch devices are coming. I mean, my laptop is a touch laptop, so even if it's not a tablet, it works great for that. But, like, what's the name of the game, first off?
Oh, well, our game is called Popcorn Panic.
Okay.
And it's about popping popcorn and then collecting it with a little bag. It's really straightforward. It's just sort of, it's an arcade game. So mm-hmm. you play until, you lose and you have 3 lives. And if your popcorn gets burnt, then you lose a life.
So how does it get burnt? Does it take too long to pop it?
Yeah. So if you take too long to either pop it or collect it with a popcorn bag, it mm-hmm. burns.
Okay, cool. So what kind of technology did you guys use to make it?
For this game, we used Construct 2 to make our game.
Mm-hmm.
Which I definitely thought was going to be a little sketchy because I kind of saw Construct 2 as kind of like Game Maker, and I saw that in the way I see Game Maker, the way I used to see it, like freshman year, I thought it was like worthless.
So why did you think that?
Because like Game Maker, like I don't know, it was ADK. It was the first game I had ever made.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a bad game. Like, I mean, it wasn't that great. So I thought that, how am I ever going to really?
There's a lot of bad games made in Game Maker, so Game Maker makes bad games.
Well, I mean, like, and then like it's like everyone in that classroom, like not everyone made such a great game. So I'm seeing like all these like not so great games, and it's like, can you really even make a great game with Game Maker?
Mm-hmm.
But after seeing like Hotline Miami, and games like that, yeah, it's like wow, like you can actually make real games. And then so Construct 2 was just, it was simple, but made a great game. So.
Yeah. So this class changed your opinion on using those simple tool sets.
Yeah. Way. Like I just, I really wanted to learn to do like crazy programming, but mm-hmm. then like just using Construct 2 to make like an equally great game, like really surprised me.
Is it also because like your classmates and you were getting better at your game development skills, so the games that you guys are making in Construct and in Game Maker are themselves going up higher quality? It's just like those games don't necessarily get shared, right? Like a lot of the higher end Game Maker games don't like advertise the fact that they're Game Maker games, right? You know, there's a couple gems that Yo-Yo Games like to highlight that these were made in Game Maker, but I think a lot of them are just kind of like you have to be paying close attention or know the developer to know what kind of tools they were using.
Yeah, there is a little bit of prejudice when using those kind of tools, and I think that stems from the fact that we're coming out of a generation known for the big programming greats. You know, like when you think of programmer, you think of Dennis Ritchie or something like that. You know, people who spend a lot of time with a computer, manipulating a command line. Not mm-hmm. to say that it's not the best way to make a game. I mean, I certainly spend my time around the command line, but this would be, I'd say, considered the year, especially looking at the history and the revision of Game Maker. that I think GameMaker really came into its own as a professional tool set. The UI, they changed their logo.
GameMaker Studio helped it a lot.
They really, as a tool set,
I mean,
really,
it was great before. I love GameMaker so much.
Right. The one
and Construct 2 and all that.
Construct 2 is great, but if I had to change one thing, I would say definitely include script support, because that when you include script support for your game, that or your engine, Construct 2, if the guys mm-hmm. out there are listening, you just have so many more options and so many more degrees of flexibility.
Construct has like this pro and con to it, because you can, you know, insert like a 2D platformer guy object, and has all that code done for you. There's a lot of really quick drag and drop. So I can make like a game from scratch in Construct quicker in a lot of cases. But then GameMaker has the advantage, it has this really powerful GameMaker scripting language that you can go off and go crazy with. Like, I have friends who made full 3D engines out of GameMaker scripting language with, you know, rigs and IK splines, just like for their own fun.
Yeah, going off that, I think there's a lot of prejudice just here with this degree against tools like that, because we're a computer science degree. So there's a lot of emphasis on using our own tools or writing our own engines and stuff. And I'm actually really for that. And if I had more than 10 weeks to spend on a game, I wouldn't use a tool like Construct 2 or GameMaker, actually, mm-hmm. because this school has taught me to be more independent. I would actually like probably want to do the engine myself and then use the engine to build my game.
Well, you guys are students, so you have the advantage of time to be able to sit down and make an engine, right? Like, if I'm talking to an indie developer and they want to make a game and they want to get it to market and they want to make money with it, using the tool is a clear best answer. You know, you're going to get to market soon. You're going to iterate faster. You're going to get better. But you're not going to use those tools well if you don't understand how they work underneath. And so the best way to really understand a game engine is to create a couple from scratch. And if you understand how an engine works, then you can start cheating it and know exactly how to cheat, exactly how to tweak it. And when you're having a problem, you aren't just saying, oh, you know, this bug, I don't know how to fix it, this function's broken somehow. You can say, okay, this buffer is doing this when I do that, because you know what those black box functions are doing. So for your previous projects, you said you were worked on three before. Did you also use tools, GameMaker in the first one, you said?
Yeah, in the first game in ADK, I believe we all had to use GameMaker? Yeah, I believe we had to, which was not too fun, I guess, since I was just starting off as a game design major.
Yeah.
And this was like, you know, the first game I'd ever made ever. So
did you guys have to do any board games or any paper prototypes?
I think for that class specifically, we had to make physical prototypes. But
yeah.
If you're talking about ADK, I know there was certain in that class there was it always depended on who taught it. The year I took it was with this guy named Ward Noah Wardrop Fruin. He was a huge advocate of paper prototypes, so much so that he spent a couple lectures on it, just going over, showing some of the professional companies' use for paper prototypes, mm-hmm. and they had a couple of concrete examples that really hit home.
Yeah, paper prototyping is really common in industry, and it's really smart because you can work out a lot of the design kinks ahead of time, and then if a game works in paper, it'll work digitally a lot more likely.
Actually, on the subject of prototyping, you could adapt with the past 15 minutes of the conversation strictly to prototyping. Construct 2 and GameMaker mm-hmm. are fantastic ways to prototype your product, especially if you're the product. You could spend a couple weeks on the prototype if you think you're going to build an engine. Maybe assign a couple people, to the team. It could save you hundreds, thousands, and if you're in a bigger studio, millions of dollars in the long run.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that's another hidden use for tools like Construct and GameMaker, because you can look at like how many polished games are released of these and how popular they were. But probably, you know, even if you use a more advanced engine like Unity, or even if you're doing it yourself or using Ogre 3D or whatever, like, you probably prototyped it in GameMaker in the same way you paper prototyped it before that, just to see if it will be fun, see if it's interesting. Because if you have a budget, you're not going to waste $100,000 in a game if you don't know it's going to work, not when it's finished.
Yeah, we were actually talking about paper prototyping with our professor in this class yesterday. And he was talking about war games. He grew up with them in the 70s, and I found it really interesting. And, you know, one thing I would like to see more is just classes dedicated to paper games, mm-hmm. because as much as I know it's a really good idea to paper prototype, I've only really done it once, and those are for small, just little prototype games that I made.
Hey, Taylor, if I recall, you participated in the Global Game Jam this year, right?
I did, yes.
Did you have to do a prototype for that?
No.
Or that you just you didn't, your team didn't drop a document or anything like that?
Nope. We just started making a game.
I mean, in a sense, the Global Game Jam game in general is a prototype, right? You're just putting,
yeah, you know, exactly. 40 hours, we only have 48 hours. Yeah.
I mean, I've seen people like do that and make a paper prototype as their final game at the Global Game Jam. It's kind of meant for digital games, but like doing a 24-hour paper prototype is just as valid as doing a 24-hour digital prototype. And for some kinds of games, you can get a lot more design work done and get more of a feel for it. I know there's like websites too that, you know, have monthly board game challenges and stuff that you can submit to. There's always an excuse to do a game jam, right, every month. I forgot. There's, yeah, like those people who do like a game every month for a year. And those are, the more games you make, the more experience you're going to get, and the better you're going to be at it.
Yeah. I definitely agree with that. I've made a lot of small games before, you know, more than just the three I mentioned. But those are more complete games. Mm-hmm. Just making small games and iterating on your ideas as quickly as possible is probably the best thing you could do as a designer, I think.
So how many more years do each of you guys have before you graduate, like approximately?
I have approximately a year left.
Okay. Yeah, same. Approximately 1 year left.
And depending on how I want to swing it, either a year or two, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, you always take more classes, take more electives, stuff happens, right?
There's just so much you want to learn.
Yeah, exactly. It's sometimes good to take more electives than you need if you can find really interesting electives.
Yeah, I feel I get better with every class.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I level up in a way.
So speaking of exactly what you're gonna, what electives to take, you guys each have a year left. What's the plan look like in that year? Are you going to make a game every month for the next year?
Oh, I wish I had enough free time to do that. It's going to be a lot of electives. We have a year-long course in our final year.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the the 170 series, where it's just dedicated to making one game over that year,
yeah,
with a larger team than what, mm-hmm, we're used to, sort of like a full-on game.
I think that was the reason I chose this major over the computer science major here. There's the computer science major, and then there's the Bachelor of Science Computer Science with an emphasis on game design. The game design program here has 1 year studio, and that gives you real studio experience. And at the end, you know, you got something for your portfolio. And it's not just some game you made in a month. It's a well-thought-out, well-documented top piece of software.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, like, it's good to have those longer-term projects, too. I'm assuming you'll, speaking of prototyping, kind of, you'll have the time to prototype different designs out, things like that. Are you guys going to try and work together for that project? You haven't figured that yet?
Oh, we still have a quarter left before you have to worry about that.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably going to be the same as this course. We'll figure it out when we get there, just, mm-hmm, sort of what ideas we want to develop on, because I still don't really have an idea for it. Some people probably do. Most people probably don't.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to ideas, the design, I mean, I see a couple of different archetype people in our classes. You know, you got guys who are really strong in programming, and, you know, they have the ideas that latch onto like the main ideas, and they're guys who think of the main ideas, and, you know, they preach those ideas, and then back,
yeah,
with the programming.
I mean, like,
and so
ideas are cheap too, right? So you gotta find people who can not just have a good idea, but be able to communicate that effectively to a team. And that's the real skill to practice.
Oh, absolutely. And then following up, you know, maybe it's not so much having an idea as having an implementable way of, you know, getting that idea into code. Yeah.
Well, what about you, Alex? What's your plan for the next year?
For the next year, I guess take as many game design electives as I can. Mm-hmm. I do feel like a little bad about only making games in game design classes specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and I've only made one per year so far. So I'd love to make more, like maybe next quarter and like, you know, even during the full 1 year long game, to be making games each quarter like that. I mean, that's a ton of work, but I'd rather get more experience in.
Yeah, I mean, you can always scope it down, right? Like, yeah. I have participated in 4 hour game jams. You will not make as polished a product in a 4 hour jam, but like you can make a game, right? Yeah. And then what's great about doing that is, let's say you do a 4 hour jam once a week for a month, then you got four prototypes of games. And you could say, you know what, that third one, that one was pretty cool. And then maybe next month you put four more hours into it. Next month you put four more hours into that one, and suddenly it becomes a full project. And then if it doesn't work out, you just jump ship to another one of your prototypes or start a new one. So you're not really as committed time-wise, right? Because you can kind of shoot yourself in the foot with working on a game for a year. Because if it's not a good game, you're going to be working on a bad game for a year, right? Not to scare you guys too much, but it's something to think about. Is that like it's better to not jump on the first good idea or jump on an idea because it's convenient, because you have so much time you can devote towards, well, ideally I would like this game, but I would need to know this laundry list of tools or the, you know, prototype these designs. So you have the time to learn those tools and do it.
It's true.
Yeah. It would be nice if the education system here kind of supported that idea, that ability to jump ship on projects. Cause mm-hmm. I've definitely been in situations where I just, you know, either the game's bad or somebody's not delivering, or if they're delivering, they're not delivering, you know, in a way that would be ideal.
Yeah. It's really hard at school teams because you don't necessarily choose your teammates, and
it's not flexible.
The consequence is grades, and some people are okay with bad grades. And so some people will maybe not submit on time, and you tell them not to, and they're like, well, I'm just going to get a C in this class. And then that may be good for them. That may be what the effort they want to put into it. But if someone in that team wants an A, it's putting in that A work, it ends up being a lot more burden they have to bear.
Well, I feel like the thing about this major is everybody puts in crazy amounts of hours. And it's difficult. I've never really been in a team where people didn't put in crazy amounts of hours. But, you know, sometimes if it's just not coming together, it'd be nice to just be able to jump ship.
Elaborating on that, Santa Cruz used to be known for having a pass-no-pass system, whereas, you know, the grade wasn't so much relevant, just so as long as you did the work and, more importantly, learned something. I mean, I think one of the core principles of game design is when you fail, you got to fail fast, and when mm-hmm. you fail often. I mean, how many times have you failed in your life?
Hundreds, right? And that's for every failure you get, you learn more. Like if I was just telling this to somebody the other day. If I'm in a position to hire someone who did 10 projects that failed or one project that succeeded, most likely I go for the 10 projects that fails, guys, because he knows a lot more. And the one successful project guy.
And that makes a lot more sense. I mean, they're going to have a lot of experience, especially if they've developed for multiple devices, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I know there was certain problems we ran into with Popcorn Panic that we initially did not see.
Yeah, so what kind of differences did you find trying for this, developing for a Surface specifically?
Okay, so the one thing, and it should have seemed so obvious that we didn't see, was your hands. Your hands are big and bulky. Well, actually, to be fair, I got pretty tiny hands. But
yeah, but it blocks your screen real estate, right?
You know, even though the Microsoft Surface is a big screen.
It's because it's a big screen, right? Because you put your whole hand over it. If it was like a tiny screen, maybe your thumbs would be over the corner. But because you're putting your whole hand on it, you have to watch that screen real estate. So touch games have to have less things going on the screen because you're only going to be looking at 30 to 40% of it when you're interacting with it.
And it's like a 10.6 inch screen across. Mm-hmm. So unless you're like a piano player, you're not going to be using your thumbs. So we had to design the UI in such a way where all the critical stuff, the buttons and stuff, were on either one side, so you could hold it up with one hand and then use your hands one single hand.
Mm-hmm.
Or we also toyed around. Another successful UI was having all the buttons on the side. And although that's pretty standard for what is it? Phones?
Yeah, mobile stuff. You have to think about this a lot.
for a tablet of the size and scale of the Surface, we kind of just played it. We spent like a day just trying to. It's kind of like sitting comfortably in an economy air chair.
Yeah.
You have to kind of wiggle around and see what's most comfortable.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to design for your small mobile, your tablet experience, and your desktop experience if you're trying to go for like the 3 minutes, and then maybe a console experience. That's probably the four main platforms that games are on right now.
Yeah, this isn't the first time I've developed for a touchscreen, but this is the first time I've developed a game and then been able to use a touchscreen to play it, if that makes any sense. Like, I've had ideas.
Actually had the device in hand to try it.
Yeah, had the device in hand to try it. I've made prototypes and I've had ideas with touchscreen games. It's just, you know, actually designing for them is a lot different than, you know, sort of classically designing for it. Because with, you know, like computer games, you have so many options on the keyboard that don't block the screen at all. And, you know, there's a big temptation to, if you put another feature in or if you have another option for the player to do, you just assign it to another key. In touchscreen games, that is definitely not the case.
Yeah, you kind of have to limit their options in that sense. I mean, it's good to have that customizable keyboard, especially if you're doing like a Windows 8 app, because they could be using a keyboard with their touchscreen. But, you know, you're going more for that pure touch holding tablet experience. Do you guys have smartphones yourselves?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we all do.
Have you tried developing for those phones?
No, but we're about to start that next quarter.
Yeah.
I've messed around with the Android development kit a little bit. You know, to say the least, I think it's a little bit more intuitive pushing stuff to the Microsoft Store through Visual Studios. The one thing I like about that in it's really integrated. So we were able to take the code, we ported our code to JavaScript, and we're able to make a comprehensive app with the built-in plugins from Visual Studio. So and also the fact that we got Visual Studio free with the DreamSpark.
Yeah, DreamSpark is nice because it gives you all the tools you need.
Yeah, that really made it. That really made development a breeze.
Yeah, I mean, you can use Visual Studio too to do, you know, your other development as well. You know, tools like Xamarin, you can make iOS apps in Visual Studio now. So it's pretty nice that you get access to that. But what other issues did you run into when, like, coding for Windows and Surface? Was it just the form factor was the biggest thing to get over technically? Was there any other challenge?
Well, I know that one of the biggest issues that we had when doing the game was not, like, Visual Studio or anything like that, but Construct 2 specifically. Source control was really difficult with our game.
Yeah, Construct probably doesn't play as well with source control.
Not at all, really. So, like, when me and Taylor were going back and forth with builds, it was, if we were working on it at the same time and we both, like, oh, like, oh, hey, like, we both just did this, like, oh, okay, well, one of us is going to have to take the changes from their builds and put it into one of them.
I mean, yeah, not to seem too much game maker praise, because we already have a bunch of show, but I really like that in studio, they made it play much nicer with source control now. So now you can do those kinds of mergings really easily. But I guess Construct hasn't done that yet. Did they have any internal source control stuff for it, or maybe it's a pro feature? I haven't looked up, so I don't know.
Not that I know of.
Yeah, the closest it has to source control is having two Construct windows open of the same project, you know, different versions, and then literally copy-pasting code from one version into another.
What kind of source control do you guys use? You use Git, TFS, Mercurial?
We haven't been able to use any source control.
You haven't done any of your projects before?
Well, for our projects?
Yeah, I mean, this
in
one.
In general, and Git. We use Git quite a bit. Oh, actually, yeah, TFS. We've been using that this quarter, but that's more for Scrum.
Yeah.
Burn down charts.
Yeah, you're using the advanced features of TFS for, like, the Scrum and whatever.
Yeah, as far as project management goes, TFS has been, you know, pretty so intuitive. It also helps to keep track of everybody, you know, because we all live in anybody who's familiar with the University of California at Santa Cruz knows that it's one of the biggest campuses by area, and we live miles apart. So it's easier for us to
just being having those files to push up. It's really nice.
Yeah. And then also, just keeping track, making, ticket items and stuff like that, that, I'd say to anybody who's looking to get into the industry, make sure you familiarize yourself with, management tools, early on, because it'll make your life a lot easier, especially when you decide to collaborate with, other people.
Have you mostly just been using Visual Studio's tools for source control, or do you use like SourceTree or GitHub's client?
I mostly use GitHub's client, mm-hmm. For other projects, because it's free and it's really easy to learn.
Yeah, it's good to put your code up on GitHub because not like if you don't really care about it being open source, then other people get a chance to use it. Other people, you know, maybe a year from now can download it and learn something from it. So it's always nice to put your code out there that you don't necessarily like need to keep it on a hard drive and have it forgotten about.
Right, because you know, student projects, we're not going to go out and make money off of them.
Well, you know, I mean, not necessarily. You can make money off a student project. And even you can make money off it even if it's open source, right? It doesn't preclude you from doing that. You know, if you make money off it and it's open source, you're going to be more copied easily. But, you know, that isn't necessarily your primary concern. So you had a quick one more thing. Okay, so what kind of games have you guys wanted to make but haven't yet? I'm sure you've been thinking about like, oh man, I really want to make the next World of Warcraft or whatever. What's your dream game that you would love to work on?
Right now I'm thinking about this idea. It's an RPG built for touchscreen devices. It's a JRPG style game. So there's kind of a lot of micromanagement and stuff. And the issue with that is, you know, keeping the combat, I guess, customizable and still fast-paced.
Mm-hmm.
It's not turn-based. It's an action RPG. And that's just...
Those are spreadsheet games right there. Designed in Excel kind of thing. You have to balance those numbers.
Yep. So, that's an idea I've wanted to develop on for a while, but haven't really had a chance. Now that I have a Surface to work with, I might just...
You're
make a prototype,
try it out in your spare time. You know, you might be able to put a couple hours into it, but you know, that time will accumulate, and that time will eventually lead to a finished project.
As for me, my dream kind of game to make would be kind of like a sandbox kind of game, mm-hmm. Specifically like a Prototype 2, and then the Infamous games. I've never play the Infamous games, but I've seen that it's really similar to Prototype, and just kind of having like an open world where you're allowed to go wherever you want, do whatever you want. I mean, there is the main storyline. You can follow that if you really want to.
Did you play through the new GTA 5 yet?
I have not. I've like games, especially like GTA 5, you know, that was one of the biggest games to drop ever. And it is just like, you can do whatever you want, whenever you want, but there was always the main mission you can do.
Mm-hmm.
But I had the feeling of just doing whatever you want. And then, like, I don't know, I guess like just that is like what I've always wanted to do. I mean,
the clear example here is Minecraft, right? Where that's the epitome of a completely open world.
Yeah.
There's no direction of what you should be doing in Minecraft. You know, people make it a challenge themselves to go exploring. Some people decide to build a giant tower. And the fact that it's multiplayer with that open world is pretty... I don't know if it was revolutionary, but it was done so well that's why it had such a cultural revolution. It was such a cultural explosion.
Yeah, it's a great game. But I guess for mine, Minecraft is that. It's a great game, but like I guess like the direction I want to go is more like Prototype, Infamous, like maybe like...
More that third-person shooter.
Yeah, kinda. A Prototype 1 I thought was... walking around as Alex Mercer... like just ultimate badass, mm-hmm. super powerful, do whatever you want. No one can stop you. I just had a blast. And I just thought like, if I could just make a game like this, that'd be good.
Yeah. I had a really good experience with the new Batman games. The Arkham Asylum, it was so great. Cause like it'd been a while since I got into one of those games. I kind of got into this mobile thing and I kind of got into this red, like, oh, maybe I don't like AAA anymore. And then the Batman games came out and it just like, oh man, I'm 12 again. I just wasted hours of those games running around and doing all the side quests.
Thank you so much for mentioning that, because I feel like I've changed my answer now to specifically Batman.
Yeah.
He is my favorite of all time. Watching the Arkham Knight trailer recently, mm-hmm. I'm I mean, now I want to be Batman. I want to make a Batman game. Just everything Batman now.
Yeah, no, Batman fits so well for that kind of game because it's all about like exploring that city and stopping crime and. Like, even though it's, like, super light, like, there's kind of this main story you can ignore. But just, like, you know, oh, someone's getting robbed. You can just go break up that fight. Yeah. And it's just, like, a thing in that world.
Well, like, Arkham City. There was just, like, missions everywhere. But there's still the main one.
Yeah, and then those Riddler puzzles are always, like, super weird. I didn't finish all of those.
Never.
Time's an issue.
That takes way too long.
Yeah. And they also let you play Catwoman, too, for different parts.
Yeah, yeah. I think there was, like, Catwoman. I think... it was Robin or Nightwing. I'm not sure. There was DLC to play as.
Oh, you know, I don't think I did a DLC. I should.
Yeah.
That's just time investment that I want to, but I mean, don't have the time. Yeah, I know. Exactly. Oh, but yeah. What about you, Ethan? What kind of games you want to work on?
Well, you know, our school's focus is procedural content generation, specifically procedural story. I'm kind of actually the contradiction of that. I have a background in stand-up comedy, so... I kind of really want to make casual games with, like, just a lot of humor, a lot of mature humor. I arguably, if it gets me up on Fox News late night because of controversy somewhere in the Midwest, that might be that I could see myself aspiring to that. And definitely, I want to go out in the world, sharpen my tools a little bit. But, man, when all said and done, I mean, only one way to go but indie.
Yeah. So what kind of comedy games have you liked in the past? It's always been kind of a weird genre of games because they often have been – more silly than they have been jokey.
Yeah, humor is a really tough thing to nail, but I think you have so much potential to do it in games. Portal has so much subtle
humor. That's a really good example of smart humor.
That's really upscale, witty humor. Some of the lowbrow humor that I particularly enjoy was this indie game called McPixel.
Mm-hmm.
Hilarious. I died. I killed myself multiple times, figuratively in humor and then literally in the game. And then I would actually have to say I played a couple Leisure Suit Larry games. Those
those classics.
Always. Yeah, that's
Armed and Dangerous, I think it was called.
No, actually.
Yeah, you should check that one out. This one's very British style humor.
Oh, great. Monty Python.
Yeah, it's very silly, but it's done in a very dry way, so it's really fun. It's pretty old at this point. No, you probably got like a dollar. It's a bargain bin to find it.
You know, there was this old game. It's on GOG, I think. Is that where old games go?
Yeah.
It's a game called Mega Race. It was just really... They had these live-action intros, very, you know, typical late 80s, early 90s type of deal. And this guy, it was... I forget his name, but he would just wiggle around like he was, drinking a lot of coffee. On screen, oh, it was hilarious, and that was one of the games of my childhood. So,
yeah, I definitely like elements of humor in games. Like South Park just came out, and it's kind of going with the RPG stuff I like, and like the humor is just it's so great. And Portal, one of my favorites still.
Yeah, definitely a good way to make a game more memorable, right? And it's kind of another thing where story does matter. Like, it doesn't matter to a point in some games, but the story doesn't necessarily mean it needs to be an epic fantasy tale or it needs to move you to tears. The story can just mean it was really funny. It was really motivating. I talked, like, on four or five different podcasts now about Gone Home, right? But Gone Home is nothing but its story. Or Brothers is another one I rant about a lot, where it's all about its story and the way it communicates that in a way that other genres, you know, like movies or books, can't. So let's wheel it back to the class here. You guys are kind of wrapping up. You know, you got the final presentations coming up. What would you say was the biggest thing you learned from the class overall? Not necessarily about Windows development, but what would you say you learned overall?
So one thing we did with our game that was really great was our scope was super tiny at first. And then from there, we were able to add things rather than, you know, this is what happens with most game projects. We have a huge scope and then we have to take out all this stuff because we don't have time to get around to it. Our game is really polished and because it started small and we added stuff. And, you know, that's a great skill that I learned, you know, start small because, you know, I don't like taking stuff out. It takes away from the, you know,
it goes back to that prototyping stuff, right?
Yep. And, you know, publishing to an app store, also something we learned. I'd never done that before. And I've heard the process is pretty similar for all the app stores. So now that I have that under my belt, I feel pretty comfortable.
What would you say that process was? More complicated than you thought it would be? Less complicated?
It was definitely less complicated than I thought it would be. It was still a little complicated, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it too hard to figure out, or do you think?
It wasn't that it was hard to figure out. It was that the turnaround time for figuring it out was a little, a little inconvenient, because we'd submit it for approval, like maybe this time it'll get approved, and then we don't know if it's approved until like 2 days later.
Yeah, because the actual human has to look at it for the approval process, so it takes, some time to turn around.
Yeah, in that regard, certification, man, keeping track of requirements for your submission is I've never had to deal with that before. All the games I've ever made were for a computer, and there's no invisible body reviewing your work silently. Unless you want to count Metacritic, right?
Yeah, well, it's that extra layer, right? Because you guys are so focused on how do I make a game, and it's like, well, what do you do with that game afterwards? Like, you want to sell it, you want to make a company run, you want to get it out there in the store. And so it's like all this extra stuff that is game development, right? But it's not actually making the game. It's a, general process afterwards. So it's good to go through it. What would you say with your learnings in the class, Ethan, besides the certification process?
Well, I'd say for the biggest learning thing I did for this class was definitely working in groups. When you're working in groups, make sure to be as human as possible. You want to, and not just like, it's important to be professional, but we're not, selling spreadsheets. We're not, at the end of the day, yes, you do have to, there has to be that professional there, but express your fears for your concerns. Express, when someone did something good, let them know that, and share that around your group. And then, as far as that goes, when you have a product, play test often, quick, and make sure you get a numerous amount of people. If you can find like a 5-year-old who's down to play your game, make sure he or she plays it, and that will you're going to get feedback that you're not going to get from, let's say, your college roommate. It's not, you're going to get different feedback, and that's going to make a better game.
Absolutely. Good advice.
For me, probably what I took away from this class and making this game was I think I got Scrum was probably one of the bigger things that I got out of this class, because I learned that Scrum is actually a big thing that happens in industry as well.
And it's not trivial to learn. You kind of have to go through it to really understand it.
For our first sprint, we didn't really deal with Scrum too much. And even now, still, it didn't happen too much. But I found that it was a really useful tool. And I feel like if we had utilized it to its maximum capacity, it would have been a great thing to do. But I think that was a really nice thing to learn this quarter, to learn that even at Riot Games, that they do Scrum there, and they have a Scrum Master specifically. And
even non-development companies now are using Scrum as a model just to rapidly prototype new ideas.
Yeah, our professor gave us, and I think it was a professor said, two guys working together, even they did Scrum together, just even though it was just the two of them, using Scrum really helped organize their stuff, and they got everything done much faster. So I don't know, I feel like Scrum is a really nice thing to have learned this quarter.
Yeah, very cool. It sounds like you guys learned a bunch. So I always like to wrap up the show with not just what guys have been making with, but games we've been playing lately. So I'll start with mine. I've been playing this game called Device 6, which is super unique. I think it got nominated for a couple things in the IGF next week at GDC, next week when this is being recorded. But it is kind of a text-based game, but the way you read that text is very unique to mobile devices. So you'll be reading that the character is walking up a staircase, and the text will then start to form a staircase and start moving upwards. Or you'll turn left, and so then you have to turn the device left, and the text will start reading there. Or you could turn right and turn the device right and read the text going that way. So as you read the text, the linear line, you're kind of implicitly making your choice in a multiple choice adventure. And at any point you can scroll back up and rewind and take a different path to make a different choice and wander around the world. it's super weird as a pitch, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's an indie game that, as I said, it's got some notoriety here. I just played through it, and it was definitely worth trying from a uniqueness perspective because there's certainly not many other games like it. What about you guys? What kind of games have you been playing lately?
Well, I know we all have been personally playing Risk of Rain because we play it together.
Mm-hmm.
That game is excellent. It's a little buggy with the multiplayer, but it's so balanced and so fun, and I've like almost mastered it, just so close to mastering it. it's, yeah, that's one of the games. And I've been playing, you know, a lot of indie games. As soon as the Steam sale comes on, I just spend $100
or whatever. The Steam sales will get you.
Yeah. Yeah, like basically every indie game you've mentioned, I've pretty much played.
Mm-hmm. I'm probably the opposite. I don't play too many indie games. The number one game I probably play is League of Legends. That is probably my favorite game.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's a couple of people who play that game too.
Yeah, there is. But of us, I'm not sure. I'm probably the one that plays the most. A little bit, Taylor. But I'm waiting on Infamous to come out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really looking forward to that game.
And new Batman, of course.
Hey, Arkham Knight, that also comes out this year. I'm really looking forward to that. But mainly like really big games that come out are the ones that I play. Not too many indie games.
Yeah. You know, indie games are a game more polished. You got the line between AAA and indies starting to blur.
It's starting to.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty blurred at this point.
I mean, definitely if a good-looking indie game goes on sale on Steam, definitely pick it up.
Yeah, and you know, just because like I love indie, I want to talk about indie all the time, doesn't mean that I want to snob AAA games. Like I was saying earlier, the Batman kind of brought me back into a love of AAA. Because I had kind of, for a couple years, not really been as into a AAA game and poured my, you know, hours into it. You know, the exception of World of Warcraft, which I have an off-again, on-again addiction to.
Me too, don't worry.
Yeah, exactly. What about you, Ethan? What kind of games have you been playing?
I've been playing a couple. This indie game made by the French company Strike Team. It's called Strike Vector. It's it's like an aerial combat game. I know my professor, Professor David Westman, really loves those kind of games. So I was like, I figure there's a new one coming out. Might as well give it a try. It's pretty awesome. Yeah. It's basically picture like Mobile Suit Gundam, like in real life. If that's how I pictured they would move. The movement, it's all about controls in that game. And then for another game I was playing, it's this old Sonic Team game, and in my opinion, the best Team Sonic game is called Billy Hatcher and the Giant Egg. If you've ever,
I haven't played that one.
Seen that copy? It's you know, it's pretty rare now. You have to go find a copy on eBay. They're actually going up in price, but it's hilariously fun. You play as this little boy who wears a chicken suit, and you basically roll around these eggs, and you try to hatch them. And the thing that after a certain time they hatch. And then the little monster that comes out, like you can do like combo power ups, and it's like a platformer. Hilariously fun.
Yeah, sounds fun.
Yeah,
I'll have to try and locate a copy to add it to my collection.
Yeah. So, what about you? You're going to GDC, right? That's coming up.
Yeah. As a recording, GDC is next week, so I will be there. But I think by the time this airs, GDC will be long over. Everyone already know the announcements and everything, so they know more in the future when they're listening. If you want to find more about me personally or like my experiences at GDC, I'll probably be writing it on my blog, TobiaMarks.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at TobiaMarks. What about you guys? Got websites you want to plug or Twitter handles?
If you, I play a lot of Counter-Strike Global Offensive. If you want to find me, my gamer tag is one of a kind, Phil Ballins. It's Phil Collins if he was a basketball player.
I don't have any Twitters or anything fun like that. I guess if you want to play a league with me, my username is Buck Marley, BUC and space Marley, MARLEY.
Cool.
Yeah, I don't really have anything like Twitter feeds or anything like that to plug right now. But if you do want to pick up a copy of our game, it is currently on the Windows 8 App Store.
Yeah, I was going to ask you guys to plug that. You can say the name again.
It is called Popcorn Panic. Mm-hmm. So just type Popcorn Panic.
Do you have like a website for it? Or are you just going to?
No, we don't have a website for it.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah.
If you want to find more about the show, you can go to beindienow.com, where it has past episodes, show notes, and it links like that, everything you need. You can also follow the show on Twitter at beindienow. Thank all of you guys very much for sitting down and talking with me. And everyone out there, go out there and make some games.